I find that the people who write and create the tracks think they are God. And the people who write the melodies and lyrics are the second-class citizens who are actually writing the song. And they give the track to 20 people, and then they decide who they like, what they like. I don't need to do that.
Yeah.
To me, that makes me insane. The top liner is so second class in that scenario. I mean, the melody and the lyric are the song.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Emmy-winning producer, songwriter, and publisher, Michelle Weiss-Maslin. Michelle has had numerous hit songs and cuts all over the world, as well as over 6,000 music placements. Can you imagine that? Winning an Emmy for her work on the CBS TV show Guiding Light, she's been quite successful in both television and films with such a long credit list that it's really hard to pick just a few. It's no surprise that her music can be heard on radio and television every single day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. What I find even more amazing is that Michelle's had the privilege to collaborate on a song with the great Bob Dylan. During the interview, we spoke about how she started as an avant-garde artist in Los Angeles, being heartbroken over Madonna comparison, why she won't write to previously produced tracks, why instrumental sections of a song don't work for songwriter pitches, and much more. I spoke with Michelle via Zoom from her home in Los Angeles. Let's start here. You played in bands before you became the songwriter that you are, the songwriter and the publisher and just the overall dynamo that you are today. Take me back to when you're playing in bands.
Yes, I was playing in bands. I started in high school like most of us do, right? You know, I was in love with making music and I grabbed some friends in school who were amazing musicians and we put a band together. And then I had a next door neighbor who owned some clubs. And this was in New York City, and that was convenient, right? He also owned Rockaway's Playland, but he was kind of a high roller. But at any rate, he owned some small clubs, so we got some gigs, and that's how we started.
And you kept playing, though. That was your thing for a long time, right?
Yes. So then when I went to college, where I didn't really go, I joined some bands and went on the road and played anywhere I could and everywhere I could. And then I moved to Los Angeles and put together my own band. And that's when I started doing original music only and doing that. So I was very much an artist, very much on the artist path, writing songs for myself, performing and gigging and hiring musicians day in and day out, right? Because the bass player and the drummer always quit. So
yeah, funny how that works, huh? Yeah, that's the thing with bands.
yeah, they're very unreliable. They don't show up. They're not on time. I used to pay them and feed them even, you know, hoping that they would stay. But, you know, if they got a better gig, they were gone.
Yeah, that's the way that works. You know, I was the same way when I went to college. I didn't spend a lot of time there because I was on the road all the time. And there were tests. I paid people to actually take tests for me and things like that. Ooh. You can get away with that back then. But anyway.
Yeah, I didn't do that, but I should have. Yeah. Smarter. You're a smart, smart guy. See, right before we came on, I was telling you that. I thought you were such a smart guy.
And well, thank
now
you.
You're convincing me some more.
But I'm going to hear about your smartness in a little bit. So tell me about when you first got to LA and you started to do your own thing, and it was pretty avant-garde, right?
Yes. Thank you for noticing and that. Yes. So it was very avant-garde. It was kind of, in those days, Kate Bush, but in today's maybe Bjork. It was very weird. I did performance art. I had films and slideshows and actors, and I had a scene where someone was on a stretcher polishing their nails and reading poetry and like all kinds of, you know, I guess considered bizarre stuff. And I wrote songs to accompany this, and I had someone who made the films and the videos to go with it. And it was this whole performance art piece.
I bet that record labels didn't fall over themselves trying to sign that, right? Because no, I'm sure they didn't know what to do with it.
Exactly. So I was super good at networking. And I went to everything. And this is, you know, before there was internet. I mean, I had to go to everything. And I made friends with so many A&R guys who were so excited to come to my show and then sat there with their mouths open, right? Had no idea what to do with it. Exactly. Like, what do we do with this? So yeah, that was, but you know, I thought I was touching people. And I realized, no, I wasn't touching people. That, you know, people like Madonna touched people. I realized that I was touching like two people. And I really wanted my music to be passionate and reaching out to people and having them feel it. So that was an interesting lesson.
And speaking of Madonna, so there was the Robert Hilburn article comparing you to Madonna.
Yes. And that was heartbreaking for me because I thought I was such a high level art person creating art. And then there was a review in the LA Times about my show. I was sick that performance. I have terrible bronchitis, and you'll hear it during this interview that ever so often I just get very congested. And so I was sick. And when I was performing, Chris Hilburn, he compared the unevenness of my voice to Madonna. And I cried for days and days and days. And everybody was writing me saying, oh my God, they compared you to Madonna. Oh my God, that is so incredible. Congratulations. Right? I mean, and I was so confused because here, this was not good to me, but to everyone else in the community in LA, that all these A&R people and publishers and managers that I knew were excited for me. So that was an interesting learning light bulb moment, you know?
Yeah, I bet. Did that prompt you into thinking more about being a professional songwriter, writing for other people or sync?
No, not yet. No. So this was way early, not yet. But what this did make me think was maybe I should write some pop songs. Maybe I should write some songs that were a little more inside. But I didn't ever contemplate being a professional songwriter. I didn't even know what that was, to be honest with you. Like, I knew that there were people who wrote musical theater because I loved that. And I had a close friend who had a publishing deal and wrote, so she was a lyricist. And I really honestly didn't know what she did or that she didn't. Like, I just knew that I wrote the songs that I performed. And it wasn't until I had a friend who was making a movie who needed songs that I wrote something that wasn't for me. And that was years later. So then I kind of became a professional songwriter and a producer kind of overnight, you know, by getting song in this movie and then getting a song in another movie. And then I was mentored by Nile Rodgers and I got, I know all these things fell into my lap and I just said, yes. Like I was, you know, then he set me up with some young songwriter producers and we wrote a song that became a big hit. And then I got a publishing deal, which I knew nothing about and didn't understand anything, but they paid me. And then I became like basically a staff writer, what one would call a staff writer. And again, I had no clue. I really didn't. I mean, I wrote weird artsy songs. And now all of a sudden, I became this writer and producer of pop music.
The interesting thing that I've always found is that songwriters are overlooked for their production skills, but yet they're some of the best producers out there because they're producing their own stuff all the time. Just if you're producing demos, they have to be really good. So the demos are, you know, like finished records, and I mean, there's no such thing as a demo anymore, but once upon a time, you know, we had to do them all the time. But professional songwriters were a notch above everybody else in production, I always thought.
I totally agree with you. And I always say, like, so my catalog spans from 1979 or basically 1980 till present. So even in 1980, I was making master quality recordings. So my demos, I place them now in sync. I mean, my demos always sounded amazing. I really didn't understand they didn't have to, or they shouldn't, or anything. I just learned how to do it, like you're saying, on the job, doing it, listening, paying attention, working with amazing people, amazing musicians, because in those days, of course, we didn't have a lot of technology. So we had real musicians all the time, and learning from them, and also realizing, Bobby, that my passion is producing. So I write songs, I make a living writing songs, but my passion is producing those songs more than writing those songs. So I like to write them, but then I love to produce them. I love arranging the instruments and getting the players and working now with the technology and engineers, and it's fantastic. And I'm so glad that I learned how to do it from the beginning. Yes, I'm so glad. And it's sad that more women don't do it either, because the deficit of female producers is incredible. And I just don't think they really want to do it, because I don't know a lot of females who produce. I know lots of female songwriters.
Yeah, well, again, it's an extra level of responsibility that not everybody wants or can do, for that matter, because there's a skill to arranging, to orchestration, and not everybody can think like that.
You're right. They don't have to either. It's not, you know, requisite to being a songwriter at all. I don't think you have to. I just happen, and you do too, that happen to love it and thrive being in the studio, paying attention and arranging. Yes.
So you came up using real players and knowing what it was like to track with real people. When technology came along, drum machines, synthesizers, stuff like that, did you embrace it right away?
Yes. I just morphed. Yes. I would say we used it as best we could to try and see, what will this do? How can we do this? My first MIDI keyboard was a Juno 106, and it was so fun, right? So I did. I worked with people who were very tech savvy. I myself am not tech savvy and never have been, and struggle a bit with tech, but I worked with people who were, and we were able to execute. Of course, remember in those days, like Dr. Rhythm, I mean, the drum machines were so bad. I mean, the synthesizers weren't awful. And the Juno 106 had some sounds. Now people offer me all kinds of money for it. They want that keyboard because the sounds are cool and interesting. But the drums, not good. I mean, that was that beginning of drum machines, not good. But we use them.
Michelle, has your method of writing changed through the years, especially with technology now? So do you write differently?
No, actually, no. So I am pretty good at morphing. So I can write a lyric first. I can write the music first, the melody first. I can write both at the same time. I can, so not really. I just morph into the situation. I like to co-write when I write alone. Also, sometimes I had this one piece. And I play very badly. I'm not a great player. I play well enough to write, but I had this guitar piece, this guitar part for years and years and years. Finally, I had a melody, but I had absolutely no lyric. It took me about 6 years till I got on one production music gig. I thought, maybe this one would, you know. So it hasn't changed, but What I don't love to do is write to tracks, other people's pre-existing tracks. I have done it, but I've pretty much eliminated it since the year 2000. I don't do it at all.
You find it limiting?
Correct. Do you?
Yeah. Well, it's the norm now to do. For a lot of popular music anyway, it's the norm. But yeah, I mean, I think it's better to be in a room with somebody and throw ideas back and forth.
Yes, correct. And also I find, though maybe politically incorrect, I find that the people who write and create the tracks think they are God. And the people who write the melodies and lyrics are the second-class citizens who are actually writing the song. And they give the track to 20 people, and then they decide who they like, what they like. And I just eliminate that. I just don't go there, do that. I don't need to do that because I'm a producer and I can produce the song up. I don't need somebody's track. I also don't like that term top line.
Yeah.
To me, that makes me insane. The top liner is so second class in that scenario to me. I mean, the melody and the lyric are the song. Yes, if one writes the track first, then they are a songwriter, right? Not if the track comes later, but if the track comes first. Okay, I get that. But to call the person who wrote the actual melody and lyric a top liner and the top line, that's the song. So that's what you copyright, the melody and lyric. So that whole top line thing makes me crazy. So, you know, but it's a generational thing, like you say, you know.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny because it never occurred to me that that was the case until you just mentioned it. But then it was very, very clear and apparent that, oh, yeah, you know, you're right. That's not right. That's not the way it's supposed to work, especially since, as you say, what gets copywritten is the melody and lyrics. It's not the track.
Right, exactly. So it makes me that. So, but you know, it's good for me. I just stopped. So I haven't done that in now almost 25 years. I just don't. People offer me tracks all the time, and it's, no, that's okay.
Yeah. So you like to write with other people, and there are some people that are really good at that. Obviously, you are, and other people that just can't get their arms around it.
You're absolutely correct. Now, I have written in my career with hundreds of people. At this stage right now, I only write with basically two people separately, not together. I have two main collaborators. One I've had my entire career since when I was doing the weird artsy stuff in 1980, same collaborator. And a different collaborator. I've really narrowed my field, and I write with major label artists. So sometimes they're part of the equation, but I rarely write with additional people anymore. I like my world smaller now, but yeah. I have written with famous people and new people and all kinds.
Okay, so song forms have changed through the years, especially since electronics are so important these days, samples, loops, things like that, where now it's rare that you have a bridge. That basically you'll have
I always have a bridge. I don't agree. I always have a bridge. And in the students that I have, because I mentor like you do and have students, and I always enforce there's a bridge. I don't think the song is done without a bridge. I need a bridge. And when I listen to modern songs and on the radio, I hear bridges all the time. So I actually do like a bridge.
Yeah, I do too. Because it can be the peak of the song. And as a matter of fact, it should be sometimes. But it's interesting because for a long time, instead of a bridge as we would know it with different changes, what would happen would be another verse or chorus with the breakdown almost, which can work. It does work.
That's
but
true.
It's not really a bridge.
I'm cool with no changes. I mean, the song can have one chord or two chords and still have a different melody.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So there's a lot of that. I do agree with you. There's a lot of songs with very few chords. One, hip hop, one, two, you know, three, yeah, right. Is a lot. Yeah. So, but I do. Yeah. Like you, I like a bridge. It's happy. I do think now the songs are short, although I've always written some short songs. My Nick Carter hit in 2002 was only 2 minutes and like 23 seconds, something like that. And that's good because they get played more.
Yeah, right.
Commercials, and they get synced more because music supervisors like it. And I mean, now I avoid a lot of intro. I avoid any kind of fade at the end. I mean, that's like the kiss of death. I avoid any kind of instrumental section in the vocal song, unless it's EDM. And then even then I throw in vocalese, oohs, ahs, yeahs, something. Because nobody has any attention span. And when there's no vocal, they don't hear it. And they're done. So that's interesting, right?
Yeah.
Solos and drum solos and guitar solos and, you know.
What was interesting about intros and outros, they were made for radio so the DJ could talk over them. And now radio is not important anymore, so they're not needed. If you look at it like that.
Yeah, sure. That's a truth. And also when I pitch songs, because of course I pitch my own songs and I sit there in meetings, anytime they come to any instrumental session, they would turn the song off.
Yeah.
They'd make a note. This is really cool. What else can we listen to? But they'd never hear the rest of the song. And I still see that today, that they don't keep, it doesn't keep their attention if there's no vocal. And if there's a guitar solo, forget it. They're finished. So yeah, I think I tell all my friends and students and everybody, don't have an instrumental section. You know, make an instrumental version of your song, run an instrumental track, but don't put in an instrumental version, you know, especially if you want them to hear the rest of the song.
There are 15 simple mix fixes that can instantly take your mixes from amateur to pro level. These are the secrets that the top engineers know that most musicians don't. That's what you'll find in my Mix Fix playbook. Head to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now.
Okay, let's talk some production stuff here, because I know you like this, so do I.
Okay.
What I've found interesting in modern music is the amount of ear candy. And I agree that you need a certain amount to keep the interest up, even if it's subconscious. But it's gotten to the point where there's never, ever a blank place in the song. It's filled up with something. There's some effect that's coming in almost everywhere, except maybe the first verse. You might have, you know, the first eight bars or something that are kind of bare. After that, it's just filled up, and more and more and more tracks on top of one another. So, in fact, we're getting a simple song that becomes really complex track-wise because there's so much going on. Is that something that you do, or do you care about? Does it matter to you?
I care that the track serves the song, the melody, the lyric, the singer. And I have a lot of breakdowns in my songs. Sometimes the top of the second verse, I'll break down completely to just vocal, a cappella. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes there's a breakdown section later on in the song that's only a cappella, or maybe vocal and drum, or that kind of thing. So I actually like peaks and valleys, and like the song to breathe and move and grow and perhaps be quiet in a section. I avoid instruments that step on top of each other, right? I don't like that. I don't like when the instruments step on the vocal.
Yeah.
If they're in the same range as the vocal, that doesn't make me happy. I try not to do that and pay attention to that. So yes, often the first verse is more sparse, but I then again break down other parts of the song so that it has momentum. And that's what I love. I love that. I don't like the songs to be completely linear. And like you're saying, I do not like a train wreck where you can't hear the instruments. Like, I want to hear what the parts are, because of course we work so hard arranging those parts and they mean so much to us. And I want to be able to have my ears isolate those parts. Now, it's true that people who are not as musical as we are might not hear those individual parts. They're listening to the melody and the lyric, right? And then the rest is supporting it. But when the musicians listen, I like them to hear the parts, to be able to isolate what, So I don't like what you're saying when there's just layers and layers and layers. And someone brought me a song like that the other day to critique, and it was like that, where it was just a train wreck of, I mean, you know, they needed not to add, they needed to take away.
Yeah.
And also everything was in the mid-range. So I think that's also a lot of producers who are not as seasoned will have everything in the mid-range and there's nothing on top and there's nothing on the bottom. And so I like to pay attention and see, what ear candy can we put that's sparkly up there? What can we put down low on the bottom? What, how can we make this a beautiful full arrangement as opposed to just lumping everything in the middle?
You mentioned before that your favorite thing was producing. But when it comes to writing, is there some, do you prefer like writing for an artist or writing for a movie or TV or something? Do you have a preference?
Well, these days, in the past, I just like to write. So I was building my catalog, which is now very large. And I wasn't even thinking I was building my catalog. I was just writing songs. That was what I did. And then I had a publishing deal and then I didn't. And I was just writing new songs and people wanted to write and new artists wanted to write. And we were just making music. And then I was pitching it and getting it placed in all these movies and TV. But today, I love writing with artists who, like major label artists, where I'm channeling them and I'm not writing about me. I love doing that. It's challenging. And I also love writing for media, for movies and TV and promos and such, like you're mentioning. I love to have those parameters where they're commissioning me and telling me, okay, here's the script. We need the songs here. And even more specifically, these days, my favorite thing to do is animation, kids animation. I love doing this. It's so happy and positive. And the last project I did, the songs came first, which often happens with animation. That is so fun. That's so fun when you get to create the songs first and then the animation is done to the songs, right? Yeah. It's so exciting. So as you're asking, I prefer these days to have a project or an artist and write that way rather than just write songs, to have more songs.
You have to tell me about writing with Bob Dylan.
I'm not sure how much I can say, but I will say that it's an amazing honor, of course, and surreal, of course, and being asked by him to do that, amazing. And I wrote the lyric, amazing, because he had some music like we all have. Like I was saying before, I had that piece of music for years. And I just could not come up with anything lyrically for it. He had some music and he likes it. And he likes the production. And hopefully he's going to work it up with his band. And that's where it is right now.
Yeah.
But, he's an amazing man. And I've had some conversation with him that was very interesting about the concept of writing for one as an artist. And basically the conversation we're having and writing for one, writing for projects that where one is not the artist. And the difference is in that, because of course he writes for himself as an artist, and he's a touring artist. He's a performing artist, and I'm not anymore. So that was an interesting conversation of how, about one who doesn't perform what they write.
Right? Yeah, I don't want you to reveal any confidences or anything like that, but
not the confidence, but
well, I mean, just to be asked to write with an icon like that is such an honor. I mean, how many times does that happen?
Beyond. I have no words for that. And I've written with amazing, amazing writers. Now, Rogers, Jerry Goffin, just some amazing talent and legends.
Was there one of these particular legends that you really learned something from that you went away on, oh, I'm going to use that?
Oh, all of them. I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time in Nile Rodgers' studio under his tutelage, and quite a few years observing and learning. And I would say that was so inspiring and significant and educational. Yes. You know, that's, but then, I mean, I was in the studio with Barry Goldberg, who I wrote a song with, two songs with, and Leland Sklar playing bass. And like, I mean, I've just been in the studio with so many masters. A friend of mine wrote a song and invited me to a session. He wrote the song with Herb Albert, and Herb was there, and he was so kind and so nice. And oh my God, you know, horns and like,
yeah.
What are we learning here? Like everything, these people are, and my husband, who is such a legend, you know, sometimes I forget because he's my husband, but yeah. I sit in the studio with him working. He mixes and engineers and my work. And I mean, come on, right?
Like, yeah,
what don't I learn? What don't I learn? You mean, I am not an engineer. I do not know what all those knobs are for. I mean, you know, I know that I want it to sound like this, and I can convey, can it have more echo? Can it have less S's? Can it have, but you know, learning how he puts all this together, amazing yeah. stuff, you know? And even people who aren't famous, I mean, my main collaborator, Larry Treadwell, who I've worked with now 45 years practically. I mean, he is so talented, right? He's so, just amazingly talented. Now, is he a household name? He should be, but no. But I mean, sometimes when he plays, I cry. I mean, he's so, the musicality that pours out of his veins is incredible. And the parts he comes up with and what he can hear, that's amazing too. Like, you know, what his hearing is, he has perfect pitch, and it's amazing. All these people, like, right? Aren't we a product of all the people that we've worked with? I mean, I work with Sarita Wright. I got to write with her and produce her in the studio. And I produce Sam and Dave. I mean,
yeah, all right.
I mean, I've been so blessed. Like, if I went through my credit sheet, I'm like, oh my God, I got to work with that person. And how is that possible? Bernard Edwards, who I got to sing for, right, on Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson's record, who I also got to work with, and just on and on and on. It's just been really, right?
And yeah, it's a good ride, yeah.
And it's extraordinary to think of, wow, all these amazing humans
okay.
that are bigger than life.
Is there one that really jumps out to you where you go, okay, I'm most proud of that?
Well, you know, No, not project wise. I mean, there are some of them I'm most proud of because they were the most commercially successful and they made me money. But my favorite project is the one I just finished for Mattel, for Barbie. I loved working on this project. It was very creative. My team of people, because you have a team when you do this, of directors, producers, and people who standards and ethics, and there's so many people involved. I loved working on this project. I was treated so respectfully, and it was so creative. And often on the projects I've worked on, I've not been treated that well. And I sadly, usually I'm just like, pay me. And I don't even care. This yeah. project was so amazing. I loved working on it, every second of it. And so I'm very proud of it because I enjoyed it so much. Right. You know, yeah. and other ones I made me money, but they always were fraught with difficulty. And my favorite song of all time, Nobody Likes and Nobody Places and Nobody Cuts, that I created. So there you go.
Yeah, there we go.
Right. You know, I pitch it and people go, yeah, that's nice. What else you got? And my co-writer on the song, the same thing. It's always the song she cites as her favorite song. And we didn't know that. We found that out independently. And the same thing, both of us. No, people are like, yeah, it's okay.
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, you know, but don't you have songs like that where no people just don't respond?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that, yeah, you go, oh, I think that was pretty good. And why doesn't anybody else understand?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. So I always feel like I let people down when I answer that question of what is my favorite. But, you know, I've had over 6,000 placements. So there's so many of them. And I've had hundreds of cuts and a ton of hit songs all over different countries and local artists, major label people on the in Romania and the Czech Republic. And so to pick one is so hard because I'm so proud that I can't even believe that, you know, sometimes people are really not nice to me and I have to read my credit sheet. And then I read my credit sheet, like someone I'm giving my credit sheet to, and I go, oh, wow, look at that. I've done some stuff. That's pretty cool. Because sometimes people don't see it that way.
I can't imagine anyone not being nice to you.
Aw, that's nice sweet, you. But you know.
Yeah, it's the business. I know.
It's the business. Yeah, I mean, I've had people say such things that are so mean that, you know, you just have to brush it off. You can't, like, I always tell people who are so scared of the rejection, you know, I get rejected all day long. The yeses matter. Only the yeses matter. The noes don't matter. You just keep moving forward. The noes are constant, you know,
Yeah.
Right. Don't you think so?
Yeah. It's still hard. Still hard to get rejected. It's still hard to hear negative things
all day. Yeah. I mean, I've heard the meanest things. I mean, just so mean. People have been so mean.
Okay, well, let's talk about something a little less mean then. And it's my last question to you. What's the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or maybe you learned along the way?
Probably the best piece of advice I learned from a teacher from high school, who wrote in my yearbook, never depend upon anyone.
That's awesome. And so true.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and that's a great piece of advice. It's not negative or sad. And for me, it's propelled my whole career and my whole life because I just go for it. If I ask you, can you help with this? And you don't show up, I don't get angry with you. I just keep moving forward because people are busy and they have things to do. and their own things to do. And sometimes it doesn't work out. And so I just always move forward and always try to get a new opportunity and don't get stuck, right? People get stuck. You know, even when you give an interview, I guess people are often discussing, well, you know, when I was 22, this happened to me and it was terrible and my whole life. No, I don't. I mean, I try to help people say that's just move forward. Don't worry about it. We all have so many stories of these things that could have set us back. But if they don't set us back, use them to propel ourselves and be positive, then I think opportunities are abounding. And so, yes, I mean, and you know, that's the first time I've mentioned that you just asked me about that person and that small sentence, actually.
Yeah. That's a great way to look at life, I think, and a great way to proceed. It certainly helped you.
Thank you. Yes, I'm still trying. So I haven't given up yet.
That's the best thing to be.
I've been doing it for decades, but you know.
Well, I'm sure you're not going to stop now. No reason to.
No, I just got a new agent. I'm very excited.
Oh, there you go. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So now you know. Every time I'm going to quit, somebody says yes. And then I'm like, oh no, I can't quit.
Yeah.
Oh,
right.
Right? Do you ever have that where you think, I'm done?
Yeah, right.
Right? It's enough already. And then somebody says yes. And you're like, ah.
Michelle, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Me too. Thank you. And I enjoyed reading your blogs, listening to your other podcasts, and to your book, reading all these books you've done. Thank you. Oh, my God.
I'm looking forward to reading yours.
Yeah, someday when I get it finished, or don't get it finished, get it published. Yes.
Let me know about that. I want to read it, and we'll have you back, and you can talk about it.
Great. I'm honored. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks very much, Michelle.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.